Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to H2O Innovation's World Water Day webcast and conference call presenting a panel of experts from the international water treatment industry. Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs, et bienvenue à la web diffusion et appel conférence de la Journée mondiale de l'eau d'H2O Innovation présentant un panel d'experts de l'industrie internationale du traitement d'eau. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Following the panel, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instruction will be provided at that time for you to queue up for questions. If anyone has any difficulties hearing the conference, please press the star key followed by zero for operator assistance at any time. Ce panel se déroulera en anglais, mais n'hésitez pas à poser vos questions en français. I would like to remind everyone that this webcast and conference call are being recorded today, March 22, 2022, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Monsieur Frédéric Dugré et Marc Blanchet. Please go ahead, gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome, everyone. And most importantly, happy World Water Day. So today we want to celebrate the fact that also H2O Innovation is getting listed now on the TSX, which is a big and important milestone for the company and its shareholders. But also we want to create more awareness about water and its industry. So today we brought a panel of experts to talk about water. And to do this, we created a small video that we're going to present you in a minute to introduce you different topics about the water industry. So welcome again, and let's get started. We'll get back to you after with a Q&A session. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. We're really happy to have you for this exciting session around water. Today's a special day for us at H2O Innovation. We're uplisting ourselves on the Toronto Stock Exchange, but it's also a special day at the global level because it's the World Water Day. And we're ecstatic to have an extremely qualified panel here with four experts to talk about water, to talk about water technology, to talk about water strategy, and to talk about water investments. I'll go right into introducing the panel, but first maybe let me introduce myself. My name is Guillaume Clairet. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for H2O Innovation, and today I will be playing the host and moderator for this exciting panel. With me today, I'm pleased to introduce Deborah Coy, who's our water investment expert. She's been investing in water for the last 20 years. She's been associated with XPV Water Partners, the largest private equity fund in Canada solely focusing on water. She's also on the board of director of Axis Water, which is the water-focused arm of KKR, an investment fund managing over $770 billion in assets in the United States. And prior to that, she was also an equity analyst analyzing publicly traded companies for Janney Montgomery, one of the leading investment banking firms in the water sector. Deborah, welcome. Second, with us today, we have Mr. Tom Pancratz. Tom is our water technology expert and guru. He works for Global Water Intelligence, and he is the editor of two important magazines, the WDR, Water Desalination Report, which is the weekly magazine that all water executives love to read. It's a weekly publication. But more importantly, he is also the editor of the CTO section, the Chief Technology Officer section of the monthly magazine of Global Water Intelligence. Prior to that, he's worked for the largest water company in the world, Veolia, and also for one of the greatest and largest engineering consultants, H2O Inhale, now Jacobs. Tom, welcome to the panel today, and thank you for being here. Last but not least, Bill Malarkey, who's the Managing Director of North America for Aman Advisors. For the one who don't know Aman, it's a really, really a trendy management consulting firm solely focused in water again. I like to refer to them as the McKinsey of the water industry. And prior to that, Bill has spent some time amongst the largest water utilities in the world, Severn Trent and American Water, which is now worth north of $28 billion in market capitalization. Bill, welcome to our panel. And last but not least is Frederick Dugré. Fred is a mechanical engineer by training. He's been building H2 Innovation for the last 22 years. This success story culminated in the award of the Water Company of the Year in 2020. Frederick, yourself, you've been named in the top 25 global water leaders on the planet twice by the Water World magazine. And probably your most important function, you also happen to be my boss. So welcome today for this interesting session together. We're going to be covering five interesting themes around water today. The first one of which is quite close to my heart and all of our panelists, and it's around water reuse. And my first question will go to you, Bill, because it's an emerging market, and goes as follows. The water reuse seems to become a major trend, both for major industrial players and for some large municipalities and public water agencies. Can you tell our audience a little bit what you think are the main drivers causing this new focus on water reuse?
Sure, Gil. I think the main drivers that you see are sort of the competition for a finite resource. So you've got increased demand, and you've got a steady or even declining water supply that's out there. So you've got industrial players, like you're seeing some of the new chip companies that are built, or chip factories that are being built in the U.S. having to put really, really extensive water reuse systems in place to become zero water users in order to get the permit to even build in certain areas. And you've got municipalities looking long-term at large groundwater recharge projects to try and maintain their sources of water. So a lot of it are those drivers of just needing to stretch the existing supply of water or recover degraded supplies. And secondly, and probably the more positive driver, those are kind of negative drivers forcing people, but on the positive side, technology advances have made it much more affordable and much more economically feasible to do these kind of reuse projects. So I think that's also driving the demand that we see there.
We have built, the largest, water reuse facility across North America. We have the largest reference install base in terms of water use plants. And it's nice to see, to your point, Deborah, that we saw over the last couple of years an evolution going from mostly municipal, some municipalities being really early adopters and tried to push the idea about water reuse for indirect potable reuse, to now seeing a greater number of industrial customers embracing this concept of recycling their water, not only for ESG purposes, but to become, as you said, more independent on their water needs and this less exposed to increasing tariffs, and also becoming more and more aligned with the regulations out there, to dispose less into critical areas. So I think H2O has technologies within the portfolio, strong expertise around membrane filtration, strong reference base, and this continuous and increasing focus towards industrial customers that will certainly benefit for the future years. So I'm truly excited about the trend on water reuse, because I will say it's not only a trend now, I think it's a necessity.
But the second topic we wanted to touch on is the one of mergers and acquisitions. And on that topic, I'd like to start back to you, Deborah, because I think we've all seen an incredible number of deals in the water sector happening in the last 2 years. 2021 was really big on mergers and acquisitions. Multiple acquirers are very active, and the multiples that they're willing to pay are as high as they have ever been, right? So I guess, could you comment on that? Do you know why this is happening? Is it mostly positive for the water sector as a whole or not? What are your thoughts?
Well, I guess the positive side depends on whether you're the buyer or the seller, right? High multiples are nice for sellers, at least until they have to live up to the expectations that are created by high multiples. I think the reason for it is pretty simple. We have a tremendous amount of capital chasing a fairly small and fragmented sector on the private water side. So there is, because of some of the things we just talked about in terms of the big drivers, there's a lot of interest. There's limited deals to be done. So there's a lot of capital chasing these deals. And I think overall, that's positive. The risk, of course, comes around whether expectations become too high. This has been a long history in the water industry where people think things can change faster than they sometimes do, and so then people get disappointed because it takes longer for technologies to be adopted or longer for change to happen in terms of spending. I think we're in a really interesting period right now where it actually looks to me, for perhaps the first time in my career, that the water industry may be living up to this, because there's a lot of money to be spent on upgrading infrastructure. I think we'll talk more about that. And there's also a lot of new interest around innovation. So it appears to me that the interest and the investor support for the sector is likely to be mostly positive.
In fact, you know, another treatment process that we've all heard about or grown up with is lime softening, where you add lime to precipitate the hardness, common for all sorts of water plants. You can remove that hardness now with a membrane using nanofiltration. So there's really a membrane for almost every application, or can be used in conjunction with any other process.
And we'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about regulation. I mean, regulations in the water industry are everywhere. They are, you know, present for almost anyone involved, whether on the industrial, municipal side. So I think it's worth to touch on them. And I, my first question will go to you, Bill, because it's really market-driven. And there's a lot of contaminants that are regulated in the water industry. But lately, it seems that all we can hear about, at least in the mainstream media, not necessarily the water-related media, but the mainstream media, is PFAS, PFAS, PFAS. Everybody talks about PFAS in the United States, at least. What is PFAS? Is that a market to pursue? It's definitely a market to watch. Is it to pursue? And what is creating that sudden attention to one particular contaminant when we know very well there's so many out there that are also important?
Okay, so PFAS is definitely something to watch. It's an emerging contaminant. I'm not going to stretch my scientific knowledge by explaining too much about the compounds behind it, but it's a byproduct of a lot of industrial processes that were used for decades in the U.S., particularly with Teflon-related products. It was also in firefighting foam. So it's something that, for better or worse, is widespread across groundwater in North America, and probably we'll see it in a lot of other markets as well as the awareness starts to rise. But where we are, and you referenced regulation early on, where we struggle now is there is a lot of recognition of the problem, but there are not uniform standards in place about what is the acceptable level of PFAS in water, and what standard then do utilities or industrial users have to reach in removing PFAS from a water supply. So it's definitely something to watch. There will be growth here, but it's not likely to be this, you know, tsunami that hits us soon of lots of spending on it. It's likely to take time for this to really hit its peak. So and as you remove it, it also, you know, it raises the question, and maybe I'm hoping Tom can speak to this a little, of what you then do with the contaminants once you remove them, because now all you've done is concentrate them either in a brine or in solids that also need to be safely disposed of. So this is one of the big trends that are coming. Other scare, you know, in the past we've seen scares around things like arsenic, around cryptosporidium. They've generally been regional in nature. I think what we're seeing with PFAS is unique because it is really widespread, and it's being regulated on that state-by-state level, which makes it uneven.
All right, so our last topic for the day is going to be the infrastructure bill, the massive bill that the U.S. federal government announced, in which there was $55 billion that was dedicated to the water industry for water, wastewater, water use projects. So, Fred, in closing, I mean, hearing all of that from our experts, do you feel that HTO is relatively well positioned to capture at least some of that new money, fresh money from the federal government?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, first, I mean, this is in our backyard. I mean, in the United States and in Canada, this is where we have most of our
currently installed base, so large number of reference, I mean, more than 750 systems already installed in North America. This is where we have also our manufacturing plant. So by being able to make U.S.-made equipment, Canadian-made equipment on both sides of the borders, position us very favorably to capture a lot of this stimulus money. I think you are absolutely right, and I've been sharing that vision, you know, for a number of years. Decentralization, small mid-sized market in the United States only. I mean, 80,000 of communities and municipalities we can count. 75% of them are serving communities of less than 200,000 inhabitants. So this is clearly the market that we're trying to go after, the small mid-sized. This is where I think the membrane technologies can provide a lot of help, can advance a lot their water and wastewater treatment and water reuse. And this is what we have been doing and continue to do. I'm also excited, and we haven't talked about it, but I'm excited. I'm a firm believer of these new technologies and digital transformation. I think the current labor market being so hard and challenging will accelerate this transition to a water 2.0, let's put it this way, finally. But now I think it's just a matter of time because technologies are out there. It's just, you know, to bring it together, put it together, and serve the small mid-sized industry where we are already very active into. Well, thank you for listening. And today I'm pleased to be surrounded by, again, water experts. We have three of these amazing water experts today for the World Water Day. First of all, I want to welcome Lisa Ann Thorne, who will replace Deborah Coy. She was already committed for the Water for People event that they're organizing today for the World Water Day. Lisa, thank you very much for joining us today. Lisa has a master in chemical engineering degree, more than 25 years of experience into membrane filtration, as well as desalination. And she happens to be also the chair of our board of directors at H2 Innovation. And as Guillaume presented, we have Bill Malarkey as well from Amman Advisor and Tom Benkratz as well from GWI joining us today. So thank you very much again. Before we jump to the Q&A from the people that are attending the call today, I just want to recall everyone that we have the complete videos available on our website at into the section investors. So you can find a little sections on video where you will have the four different videos or in a more detailed manner addressing the four topics we have discussed today: water reuse, the merger and acquisitions, the increasing regulations related to emerging contaminants, and finally, the infrastructure bill. All right, so we're going to open up for questions. I see we have a great audience on the web platform as well on the line. So, operator, we're just going to open up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
While we're waiting, I'll let you go, ma'am.
It's okay. For people over the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, press star one on your telephone keypad.
I'd like to, while we're waiting for people to answer questions or put questions on the chat, maybe something that I've been asked very often, what is water reuse?
Well, it's a good, I think, you know, maybe to your end, Tom, to explain some history about water reuse, how has that started in the United States will be, I think, relevant for the audience.
Okay, you directed that to me, Fred?
Yes, please.
Okay, yeah. Well, water reuse, like desalination, means different things to different people because a lot of water is already reused by simply filtering the effluent that comes from a wastewater treatment plant, and it's used for watering the medians or golf courses and so on. But there's recently been a big uptick in the number of plants that are treating the water to much more advanced levels. In fact, using membrane technology, microfiltration, ultrafiltration, followed by reverse osmosis and disinfection, where they're producing water that's equal to or better than the potable water standards. That doesn't mean that the regulations are in place that you can always do that and drink it, but they're certainly demonstrating in many parts of the world and certainly around the United States that you can do it effectively. Now, in most cases, the water reuse for drinking purposes is referred to as indirect potable reuse. This is where you treat the processes through the membrane application or membrane technologies I just mentioned, and you produce this high-quality water, and then you pump it into an underground aquifer or into a reservoir where it stays for 6 months or a year prior to being withdrawn and then used in a or treated in a conventional drinking water plant. But the real exciting aspect of reuse is direct potable reuse, where you treat the water coming from a wastewater treatment plant, again, through these membrane processes and produce a drinking water quality, and it's introduced right into the drinking water network and distributed. This is something that's being done in very few instances around the world, but it has been done successfully, and there's technology being tested and put in place right now to provide real-time analysis of the water quality to ensure the public health regulations are met. So, again, there's reuse, which can be done for a number of general applications. There is indirect potable reuse, which first goes through an environmental buffer, a reservoir or an aquifer, and then is withdrawn for potable reuse and direct potable reuse. So those are the three types of reuse we generally come across.
Correct. I think we'll have to get over it and change probably the psychology and acceptance, general acceptance, to move towards direct potable reuse. So I will defer to the operators and see if we have questions coming from the web platform, please.
We do not have any questions over the phone at this time.
All right, let's go to the chat room and see if we have any questions. Mark?
No, but I will throw another question. Another question that I receive very often is, as a Canadian company, are there any restrictions related to the big water bill that's coming up with Biden? I mean, there was something a few years ago with Buy America. Are we restricted with as a Canadian company to benefit contracts?
Maybe it's a good, yeah, that's a good question. So maybe I'll let you, Bill, first answer maybe the environment right now in terms of infrastructure investment, and then I'll take maybe the questions at the end. Bill?
Sure. There are restrictions on there. It's actually a strengthened Buy American provision in the infrastructure bill that's come out. And while that may seem like something that the U.S. manufacturers would often be in favor of, a lot of them actually push back against that. While it's very popular politically, it actually creates a lot of complications for many manufacturers because they're also sourcing components for their systems from a lot of different places. I think in your case, where you have operations on both sides of the border, it probably is less of an issue, or at least gives you a lot more flexibility to work around that.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and we faced the same challenges in 2008, 2009, where there was also stimulus money coming from the Obama administration. And because, as you mentioned, Bill, we have been able to manufacture goods and systems and equipment on both sides of the borders, you know, we were essentially making an American-made product as well on the south of the border. So we're fine with it. Mm-hmm. I think we're very well positioned. Now, the question is, how long will it take before we're starting to see this $55 billion bill coming, you know, coming through? So,
yeah, I think it's important to remember aside from the headline number, you're right. There's the $55 billion, but it's to be spent over a decade. So, I think you'll see more of a long, steady payout of that money that's been made available as the projects work their way through. A lot of the funding, while some of it is targeted to emerging contaminants like PFAS and another bucket is targeted towards lead service pipe identification and replacement, the majority of that spending is the refinancing of existing programs that are usually at the state level. So it's going to take some time to work that through the process. And I think what we have to hope doesn't happen, and you referenced the 2009 stimulus. What we saw at that time was actually some delays as municipalities waited to see if they could get free money to do projects that they had already identified. So hopefully we won't see that sort of delay in existing projects at the beginning of this process.
All right, so we'll go back to maybe either the web platform again or to the chat room if there's any questions.
We have some questions from the chat. First question coming from Ian Elgin. What does the panel think will be the first niche in the water industry where the bubble will burst in terms of buyer overpaying for M&A deals, which then fails to deliver the promise pro?
Well, that's a good, it's a really good question. And this is something that we like to say, Mark, staying disciplined on the acquisition side. Well, initial first for us, I mean, again, we'll remain very disciplined. And yes, there was a lot of inflation lately on the multiple paid for companies in the water space. Maybe, Bill, because of your background as well with M&A as a man, advisor, and associate, if you want to answer first, that will be, I think, relevant for the audience.
Yeah, I think where we saw a big increase in investment and where we are seeing growth, but it may not come as quickly as some investors had hoped, is on the digital side. The pandemic and initially the quarantining of workforces and then the need to work from home, things like that, it really gave a true boost to investment by utilities, by industrial users, into digital technologies for monitoring, for remote control. And there was also a burst of investment into this spot, often at very high valuations. So while I don't have a doubt that the uptake of digital technologies is going to continue and that it's absolutely necessary, I'm not sure it's going to come at the pace that some of the early investors had hoped when they piled into those technologies early on.
And maybe to compliment Lisa, because I know you have seen the water industry evolve over the last 25 years plus, you know, and evolve, you know, as membrane filtration has evolved, but also surrounding technologies. In terms of M&A, do you see a trend or you see emerging technologies and how will that, you know, impact the overall landscape in the water industry?
Yeah, I think, you know, Bill just hit on the whole digital revolution that's occurring in the water sector. And, you know, I think we're all watching that very closely. New companies are popping up. There's significant growth that's occurring. You also, you know, see a real development in the areas of the emerging contaminants and removal of these contaminants and new membrane products that specifically address those. So from a you know, innovation perspective, I think those companies are, you know, growing up, and there's a lot of interest in acquiring those early on to get a good price for them.
Interesting. All right, let's go back to the questions also in the chat room, Mark.
Yep. So we have another question from Ian. The natural of the current drought in California suggests that there should be hundreds of reuse projects being procured right now. To that, what extent that is the case, and if not, what are the barriers to adoption?
So maybe if you want to compliment and start with this, Tom, what are we using in California?
Yeah, well, there certainly California, because of its ongoing drought, is probably the most active in looking at potential reuse applications. And in fact, they've got a long history. They've been looking at potable water reuse since the 80s. They've got several big projects underway. I think that the H2O Innovation won one of the big ones there, or at least one of them. And they've got a lot more in the pipeline. There's going to be a lot of activity in California. But, you know, one thing to remember about reuse is that, you know, you can't reuse your way out of a drought. And environmental flows are still an important part of our ecosystem. And the environmental flows being that treated effluent from municipal wastewaters that's discharged into streams. So there, you certainly need to make sure that those rivers are ecologically sound and have enough water for the wildlife and for the environmental purposes. But reusing a portion of that water is a big deal, and nowhere in the U.S. more so than California. One of the biggest projects in the world right now, outside of Singapore, is probably a reuse project that's being looked at in San Diego. So it's going to be an area of a lot of reuse activities.
Yeah, and this is a project that actually HUO is currently involved with. And we started, even though there was delay, but now the project is being resumed. So let's go to maybe another question on the chat.
Yes. So from Frederic Tombe from Desjardins, do you expect environmentally friendly green chemicals to play an increased role in water and wastewater treatment globally versus traditional formulations?
Well, I have an answer for this, and maybe I'll be curious to go to you, Lisa. Again, you saw the desalination industry evolve through the years, and I'll let you answer first maybe on this.
It is a question that's near and dear to my heart, and HUO Innovation, I think, has done a great job in really focusing how to make water treatment chemicals greener. You see a lot of interest now in even, chemicals with natural formulations that are growing in interest. Even alginate-based chemicals have, for flocculants, for instance, have really become attractive. But there's a lot of ways to define green chemicals. You can remove a lot of the water and shift the chemicals in a condensed form, which really reduces the greenhouse gas emissions associated with transporting those chemicals, especially if they have to go long distance. Being able to whip up those formulations locally or very close to the market is another way to make these chemicals greener. So it is an area where there is a lot of interest now, and I think quite a bit of additional progress that we can make as an industry towards using greener type chemicals.
Thank you, Lisa. That's a great answer. Indeed, we're being green on both sides because, of the concentrate formulation, reducing freight costs, which has increased definitely in the last couple of years, and as you said, because of our formulation, because of the green chemistry we're using. So I think, Frederic, on this, we have a really bright and exciting future. I mean, we had this green chemistry and green formulation since the acquisition of PWT that we did back in 2008, 2009. But now, pushed by ESG, pushed by, the cost of freight, pushed by this willingness to reduce phosphate as well. Into discharge, I think, are driving factors that are accelerating the adoption of our green chemistry around the world. All right, let's go back to the chat for more questions.
I have another interesting question. I'm sure you like this one, Fred, from Troy Sun. Given the ongoing geopolitical conflict in the world, energy and agriculture independence have been brought to the fore. For the foreseen and increased private sector CapEx for those end markets, have you had any earlier discussions with any energy renewable AG clients? AG clients, which would be agriculture clients.
So, yeah, this is a very relevant and timely question, I think. And it's of general interest, I'm sure, for many of our experts this morning. But, yes, I think the cost of energy and the energy transitions we're going through and combined to this growing cost of energy will accelerate, again, the adoption of reusing or extracting the value of any waste and then reusing it for the agriculture, most importantly. So I think, again, we have the technologies. Technologies are out there. Us, H2O as integrator, we're looking now for things that could complement our current offering. And start to do more in that field for water reuse. I'm telling you, we're going to miss food before we miss water. And this is by far the industry that consumes most of the water. 70% of the water being treated, being produced, goes to agriculture, goes to irrigation. So this is why we need to be smarter at it. This is why we need to be innovative and extract the most of it. I don't know if any panelists want to add maybe on this topic, the nexus between the food, agri-food, and water.
I could say briefly, it does point up, though, to one of the earlier points is that competition for water resources. So as we try to become, as countries try to achieve more independence in energy production and food production at the same time with a growing population, there is a limit to how far you can go. So it forces industry and agriculture and municipalities all to become much more careful, much stingier with the way they use water, which brings us back to reuse, brings us back to water saving technologies. I think there's a lot that can be done there, particularly as you start to, we do expect to see energy production domestically ramp up again at these price levels. So there should be more scope for the treatment of water from oil and gas production, and how do you use that possibly in a smart way that also benefits ag production. There's been some interesting projects down in Texas in particular in this direction.
And I think water reuse and decentralization is the key, particularly for the agri-food market. So really a very relevant question. Someone else from the chat?
Yes, another question from Andrew Leno from National Bank. In light of current geopolitical events, the U.S. government has warned of potential cyber attacks on U.S. infra. Any comments for the water industry?
That's a very relevant topic indeed. Maybe Tom, do you want to comment on this cyber attack on U.S. infrastructure and threats and how the market is reacting and how the industry is reacting?
Well, I have a little bit of insight into that. It's certainly an area of concern, and we've already seen some hackers gain access to, I think, a water plant in Florida a couple of months ago. And this is something that everybody is worried about as the digitization that is taking place within the industry. There's more and more real-time monitoring of systems that's being done in many cases remotely and always offers a possible entry for someone who's up to no good. So this is a question that we've put to some of the companies specializing in digitization, and they seem relatively confident that there are ways and things that can be employed to protect it. I can't address the specifics of it. I don't know a lot about the workings of these things, but it's something that we certainly have to be on the lookout for and take precautions to safeguard our systems.
Well, if I may add, I can tell you that on our end at HQ Innovation, it is part of our ESG plan. We have one of our six key objectives that we have defined as cybersecurity. And cybersecurity not only for H2O, but also, you know, to make our customer better and more safe. So we're going actually through regular class training for all the operators, but also more and more trying to go and bring this knowledge and bring this training to our customers to protect their assets, to protect their infrastructure as well. So in the coming years, so not only we'll become more aware, but we're going to give additional training to our operators and to them also to protect the assets of our clients and use technologies out there to also protect these assets. So it's something that is definitely growing and something inevitable that we'll continue to monitor and watch.
Fred, we have another question from the chat, a very interesting question from Elisa Esperanza. With so much new investment in water infrastructure, increased M&A activity and inflation pressure, how does H2O successfully compete for top talent?
Yes, with the current inflation, you know, competing for talent is definitely an area of interest. It is challenging. I think in H2O, I'm really proud to say that through the years, we have built something unique, something where our culture is being so strong that it differentiates us tremendously. What we're offering as an employer, I think it goes beyond of providing a job only. It's a career. It's an opportunity to grow. It's an opportunity to change the world, essentially. And I think, you know, the water industry has a lot to offer. I think we have to do a better job in promoting what we do and promoting to young engineers and recruit more of these young engineers and young operators to join in. But yeah, it's an area, as many other areas, where, you know, we're competing for talent. But I'm really proud to say that out of the 912 employees we have, we're doing a fairly good job, and where we're going to treat and address, you know, our employees, again, as part of our ESG plan, with more diversity, with more equity across the board, will be a way also to retain more and more of our talent.
Question from Naji, who's works at the Industrial Alliance. What is the underappreciated aspect of your company for the water market today?
Well, this is a big question too. I would have said, I mean, not too long ago that, you know, our secret weapon or the unknown was literally the green chemistry that we have, but finally we're starting to see momentum being picked up. I think for some of our clients, they don't know necessarily what's the full H2O offering, how we can, you know, combine the expertise that we have between the operation and maintenance and the technologies and the building of equipment experience and our specialty chemicals and other components. I think the unknown and the tremendous value of H2O innovation relies on how much we can bring synergies between the different business lines we have. And today, there's nothing that excites me more than to see collaboration currently happening between Piedmont, one of our business line division, selling filter housing, selling filters, selling couplings to largest, you know, one of the largest desalination plants and many others. But also, as they do this, bring this knowledge and this expertise as well on the chemical side, so bringing synergies and changing and developing new products, integrating more easily the synergies, integrating more easily the chemicals also in as part of the solution. So the unknown, I think, if I had the chance to show everyone H2O innovation, will be the amount of synergies we have within H2O and the talent we have in our company.
Fred, if I could just link on to that, for, you know, the aspect about what's maybe underappreciated about the water industry more broadly, and whether that's for an investor or for a new, you know, someone entering the workforce and looking for a career, is just the breadth and the variety of the interest, I think, or of the impact that water has across industry, across politics, across so many aspects of society. People think of it as it's very narrow, it's water supply, and it maybe is just municipal water supply. But it's amazing how many pieces of daily life the water affects and the impact that you can have by choosing either to invest or to seek a career in the sector.
I have another question, Canada, can you comment on the federal government settlement with First Nation and implication for H2 innovation?
Well, the First Nation is definitely a market of interest. We know they have tremendous need for water and wastewater. The treaty itself that was signed, I wouldn't be in a position yet to comment on it, but I can tell you that we have done probably about 30, 35 water and wastewater systems so far for First Nations across Canada. It is definitely an area of interest for us. For multiple reasons, because I think, again, the membrane technologies is suitable for their needs. Also, the fact that we can bring the expertise in terms of operation and maintenance and train properly the operators. I think, you know, it's an area that we're going to see growth in the coming years. There's a lot to be done for First Nations. And again, I think the membrane filtration compared to other conventional technologies will allow better treatment, safer treatment, with minimal chemistry at the end.
Another one, outside of U.S. and Canada, where do you see the best market opportunities to meaningful grow your business or the sector of the water business?
That's good. So maybe, Lisa, in terms of the international exposure and where do you see growth, I'll let you comment on this.
Well, certainly the Middle East for the desalination growth itself is really amazing right now. And we see a tremendous amount of opportunity there as they continue to install large-scale desalination facilities that utilize a lot of H2 innovation products across the board. So that right now is one of the most interesting markets in terms of sheer growth. Then you have, you know, specialized areas of the world that are areas that are really focusing on some specialized markets. Certainly Southeast Asia, and some of the regulations that they have imposed in that part of the world that are requiring extensive reuse of water from across industries. And then you look at like North Africa also has significant growth that is pushing additional desalination facilities to be installed, for instance. I think also on a global level, just our context of our discussion on reuse is very important. We've been focusing a lot on municipal reuse in the United States, but you know, from the perspective of sustainability practices to begin with, you have a very significant interest in living more sustainably across the world, particularly in the developed countries. And so, you know, municipal reuse and industrial reuse across the world is going to be a very significant growing market of which H2 innovation can play a very important role.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lisa. Another question here from Najee. Given the robust M&A landscape, how do you maintain discipline and continue to source attractive acquisitions?
Well, I think there's, on our end, maybe, and then I'll defer to you, Bill, maybe for the landscape of acquisition. But for H2O, I think to remain disciplined will be to also target a certain category and size of transactions where probably we have less noise and competition when it comes to buying companies. And I think, you know, there's a lot of these opportunities out there. We're currently working on a few, and this is what we'll intend to continue doing. So I think the area between the 10 million to the 20 million kind of size in terms of revenue is an area that is currently less covered by potential buyers out there. Maybe if you want to compliment and give your perspective, Bill.
Sure. I think the most important thing where we see investors and strategic buyers who are most successful in staying sort of reasonable and disciplined in their M&A approach is sticking to a plan, that they have a well thought out strategy for M&A, and they're really looking at how well it fits with their current portfolio or with their investment plan, and not to be kind of carried away by the scarcity that's in the market. The temptation to jump on something because it's available and because there is a scarcity to it. I think it's also about looking really hard and having the discipline to dig in and really test the assumptions around an acquisition target. A lot of our work is actually for investors conducting the commercial and the strategic due diligence on targets and digging into the growth plan that the target is showing, what their assumptions are, what the market outlook really is, and what the company is actually positioned to deliver in terms of its competitive positioning, in terms of its real capabilities and its reputation in the market. So I think it is about discipline in the sense of asking the right questions, digging in deep, and not being caught up in the hype and the high level growth numbers that you might be seeing for a given sector.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. And I think, you know, for H2O, more particularly, we presented also to our shareholders as part of our 3-year plan what's our plan for acquisitions. I think it's pretty clear we want to continue to focus to grow the operation and maintenance platform as we have done. Just before Christmas, acquiring 2 companies in the state of New York. We want to further grow also and add more specialty products and complement and continue to focus on water reuse. So this is the things that we're currently on the look to complement the portfolio and further grow this large distribution platform we have built, you know, for the desalination and other markets. So we'll continue to execute our plan and stay disciplined.
Another question here. What are the biggest supply chain issues facing the water industry today? And then how is H2O managing the supply chain? how is the company working with customers to mitigate some of the cost challenges?
Well, that's a very, very, very good question indeed. It's a reality. Maybe Tom, on your end, because I know the membrane industry is going through changes and a lot of inflation from membranes, for example, and other components. And then I'll wrap it up at the end, maybe, of your answer, Tom.
Okay. Yeah, this supply chain issue is certainly causing problems. I recently did a story on what's causing inflation, what's causing an increase in the cost of water treatment technologies. And some of the people that I talked to, especially on the OEM side, were concerned about the transportation being the biggest problem, not only in getting the parts to them, but in finding trucks to take away the systems once they've built them or built sub-assemblies for the next level of manufacturing. But one of the problems is the cost of shipping things from China, or containerized shipments. Containerized shipments that a couple of years ago, or even a year ago, I guess, went for $3,000 to $4,000 from China, are now costing five and six times that. In fact, there's some cases where manufacturers or customers have reported paying $40,000 to get a container out of China. So, and on top of that, you've got the delays. And the problems are, you know, a number of problems. One, the Suez Canal problems, the geopolitical problems we discussed earlier, and the pandemic, of course. There's people are still trying to get out from under the backlog of shipments that were delayed due to pandemic-related issues. So there's a lot of problems in the supply chain. We see that in our everyday lives with automobiles that are dependent on chips, getting them here. The same problems manifest themselves in water and wastewater treatment. Just a couple of weeks ago, nickel was a big issue. It was pulled off the London Exchange because it increased, it went from $48,000 to over $100,000 overnight. And there are still problems with the nickel market. Some of that is because it's a significant percentage of it is sourced through Russia and the Ukraine. And it's one of the most important components of stainless steels. So there's a lot of issues, but there's a few of them. Fred, I'll let you finish up on this.
No, definitely. And that's a really good point, because the stainless steel industry is definitely an industry that is very important to the water industry, but it might become an opportunity as well to explore new materials. For example, I know FRP have been used for many years for different things and different materials, even building skids in FRP. It was something that was done by a few, but at that time, the economical value did not make sense. Today, we have reached a point where it could make sense to build things in FRP more than it was a few years ago. Same thing with aluminum. Could we use more and more aluminum into our design and other material to overcome and mitigate some pricing on these components? In H2O innovation, I think first it's important to remember that we have about 25 to 30% of our revenues coming from the system equipment business. So our exposure also to this high inflation is somehow limited and contained. Second, in terms of mitigation plan, we are extremely agile. We are extremely proactive and engage ourselves into the conversation with customers and look for price escalation, look for CPI or adjustment on our existing contract, and obviously being extremely diligent in adjusting our price for future projects that we're trying to win as well. So it is a big challenge. Extreme volatility is changing every day, every month. But I think we have tools and we have a team now because we created a procurement department about 2 years ago, and this is very helpful to mitigate these issues related to supply chain.
Fred, I'll propose a last question. From Alain Paquet, Canaccord, how important is membrane filtration technology versus other technology in the overall filtration solution out there? mainly for water use, but not just for that in general?
Obviously, it's a good question, and I think I'm a little bit biased because obviously it's somehow our expertise, but I'll be curious to hear maybe both of you, Lisa and Tom, because I know membrane is close to your heart as well.
I think that I, too, am a bit prejudiced. I've worked most of my career in using membranes, both in desalination and infiltration. There are certain benefits of using membranes in filtration that you don't get from a more typical conventional media filtration. And some of that is around virus removal, for instance. So if you have concerns about treating surface water or reusing water from multiple sources, membranes are a superior product. Historically, conventional or media filtration was cheaper, right? That was a big hurdle for membrane filtration. But over the last decade and a half or so, the pricing for the two products has become quite similar. So there's not a lot of price drivers to push conventional filtration. Often you can use fewer chemicals also when you're using membrane filtration. So it can improve the greenness of your water treatment, for instance. So I'll let Tom weigh in. I'm sure he has some thoughts on this topic as well.
Well, unlike you both, I'm, open-minded. I'm very objective on this subject. But with that being said, the fact is that there, and as I said it in a little snip at the beginning, there's a membrane for almost every water treatment job. And the biggest difference is that the membrane is an absolute barrier against the passage of a contaminant. Now, you pick the contaminant you're trying to get rid of, and you have to pick a membrane that's suitable for it, and sometimes it takes a lot of pressure or more pressure. So you've got to be careful in that. But the fact that if the membrane is, if you're operating it properly, if it's applied properly, the particulates just simply can't get through it. Now, that doesn't mean that sand filtration, there isn't a place for it, because there is a place for it. But as we're finding more and more contaminants, these microplastics, as we're finding the PFAS that Bill mentioned earlier, and some of these other constituents, the best, most effective way to remove them is usually with a membrane. So, I pointed out in the little snippet that the lime softening, which is one of the oldest conventional water treatment practices, can be done now with nanofiltration. So there are a lot of membranes for a lot of, for just about every job out there, and it's a matter of selecting them, applying them, and manufacturing them competitively.
Well, thank you both to you, Tom, and Lisa. And that will end the call today, actually. And again, thank you very much for taking the time to my colleagues, Bill, as well, for joining the call, Lisa and Tom. Again, I wish you a great World Water Day. The first step to build a better planet is indeed to take care of our water. And I think to talk about it on the World Water Day makes a lot of sense to create more awareness about issues, future, and technologies. So thank you for joining me. I wish you a great day and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
This concludes today's webcast and conference call. You may now disconnect.